If you will please take out your scripture sheet. To find a Mother's Day text, I had to go to the end of the book of Proverbs. I'm fortunate that as I read this passage about the character of a godly man, the character of a godly woman, especially with the women I have many reference in my life. First, my grandmother Lida, who bought me this preaching robe. Secondly, my mother in Chiral, who was asking the Lord why I'm not there with her today. And then my wife and my daughter, who was seated right out here. I'm surrounded by fine examples. Proverbs chapter 31 is the capstone of the biblical book of wisdom. It falls into two parts. The mother of the king asks her son a question and then talks to him about the character that a male leader is supposed to have. And she's very blunt. We wonder why his father did not give him this teaching and why she's having to make up for the gap. But then, because king needs a good wife, she takes every letter of the Hebrew alphabet, because this is an acrostic poem, and she lists an ideal and a virtue. The second half of Proverbs 31 was probably sung in Hebrew to fix it in the mind with the melody and with each successive letter of the alphabet. So as the king met young woman after young woman, he could just sing the song to himself and see how close she came to the ideal. The words of Lemuel, king of Massa, which his mama taught him. What, my son, what son of my womb, what son of my vows? It is not, give not your strength to women, your ways to those who destroy kings. So promiscuity is out for the king. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, not for kings to drink wine, or for rulers to desire strong drink, lest they drink and forget what has been decreed and pervert the rights of the afflicted. Give strong drink to him who is perishing, and in wine to those in bitter distress. Let them drink and forget their poverty and remember their misery no more. Kings ought not be drunkards because they have great power. Open your mouth for the dumb, for the rights of those who are left desolate. Open your mouth, judge righteously, maintain the rights of the poor and needy. Kings are to use their power for the good of the realm, particularly for the poor. And if King Lemuel is this kind of a man, then maybe he will listen to his mother's second question. A good wife, who can find? She is far more precious than jewels. The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. She does him harm and not good all the days of his life. She seeks wool and flax and works with willing hands. She is like the ships of the merchant. She brings her food from afar. She rises while it is yet night and provides food for her husband and tasks for her maidens. She girds her loins with strength and makes her arms strong. She perceives that her merchandise is profitable. Her lamp does not go out at night. She puts her hands to the distaff and her hands hold the spindle. She opens her hand to the poor, reaches out her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household are covered in scarlet. She makes herself coverings. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them. She delivers girdles to the merchant. Strength and dignity are her clothing, and she laughs at the time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. She looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed. Her husband also and praises her. Many women have done excellently, but you surpass them all. Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Give her the fruit of her hands, and let her works praise her in the gates. During a drought in Australia, the creatures of the bush became so thirsty they braved the dangerous dooryards of settlers for a drink. The settlers whose sheep died like flies for lack of water were constantly on the alert lest wild creatures drink the water that was left, and each man hung a rifle near the doorway. One hot summer day, a settler noticed some movement in the brush. Instantly, he seized his gun and stood ready. Out of the bush came a young kangaroo with a young one in her pouch, loping across the parched open space surrounding his homestead. Nearer and nearer she came, her huge brown eyes fixed beggingly on the settler. She made her way to the tub of water, placed there for the use of the few domestic animals that survived. Reaching the tub, the kangaroo waited, her soft gaze fixed on the man, while the young kangaroo in her pouch drank its fill. Then she turned, and without taking a drop for herself, loped back across the arid open space and into the tangled depths of the bush. The settler watched till she disappeared. Then he hung up his gun and, with a lump in his throat, went back to his work. It is a sentimental story, but it touches on a truth that has set me back on my heels more than once, and that is the courage and sacrifice and beauty of mother love at its best. Many times I've seen it in hospitals, it is always tenderizes my heart to see a mother holding her first child and then breastfeeding him. It is a bond of mother-child love that I cannot participate in as a man, and I always view it from outside with wonder and awe at the work of God. It reminds me that I too was once a helpless, wrinkled baby boy, freshly severed from my umbilical tether and in need of warmth and food and touch. And that is the fundamental reality that Mother's Day brings before us. That though our fathers provided genetic material and hopefully protection and love, it is our mothers to whom we are primarily bound by God's design, as we are knit together with the genius of DNA in the depths of her womb and welded into her heart. In the bonding and love of a mother and newborn, we catch the love of God, whom we call Abba Father, but who loves us like a bomb. Now, Mother's Day is a mixture of national origins and religious faith. It was President Woodrow Wilson who in 1914 declared that the second Sunday of May every year should be celebrated as Mother's Day. But Wilson's declaration was only the end of a long journey that began with Miss Anna Jarvis, a Methodist Sunday school teacher in Grafton, West Virginia. She was born in 1832, and like many women of her day, carried a load of grief that we cannot bear. Of her 12 children, 8 died in childhood. But grief did not crush her. In her small town of Grafton, West Virginia, she started clubs of mothers to work for better health care and nutrition for their own children. After the Civil War, these clubs held meetings to help patch up feelings between West Virginia soldiers, some of whom had worn the blue and others who had worn the gray. Now, some of the qualities we read about in Proverbs 31 were found in the life of Anna Jarvis. In her own way, she was an advocate for women and mothers, and she nurtured the dream that one day there would be a national holiday to celebrate the love of mothers. But it was left to her namesake daughter, Miss Anna Jarvis, to make the dream a reality. After her mother's death in 1905, Anna devoted her life to seeing Mother's Day become a reality. She made speeches and wrote thousands of letters, and so 3 years after her mother's death in 1908, she organized the first Mother's Day celebration and arranged for a sermon to be preached by a Methodist pastor in honor of motherhood. The service lasted from 8 o'clock in the morning till noon. So never complain again about me being long-winded. Next to Christmas and Easter, Mother's Day is the thirdly most widely celebrated history among Christians around the world, and it's only a little over 100 years old. Isn't that remarkable? Now, Proverbs 31 introduces us to the royal wisdom of a queen mother that she passed on to her princely, kingly son, which he memorized and passed on until it was made the final chapter of the book of Proverbs. It is where wisdom is headed, to courageous leadership and to honorable relationships between men and women. Now, when my mother wanted to get my attention, she would use my whole first name, not Phil, but Philip, and she would invoke the name Carlisle. I guess she figured that I was the only one that had that name and that Thrillkill was probably overkill. And so, Philip Carlisle. Well, that is what the king's mother does in three questions. Look what she says. What, my son? What, son of my womb? What, son of my vows? What, my son, I gave you birth? What, son of my womb, you were conceived in here? What, son of my vows, I was married to your daddy. I have a right to talk to you. You're a king. She talked to him about sex and drugs and power. I mean, she sat down and had a face-to-face talk with some of the toughest objects in life with her own son. After all, what mother wants her son to grow up to be immoral, a drunk, or a scoundrel? But notice how she shapes her training in memorable ways, using patterns of three, using echoes of language, and crafting a wonderful 22-line poem based on the Hebrew alphabet so this king knows what a good woman is. A good woman, she said, who can find? This was a wise woman. She had seen kings go wrong, and she knew that the first thing her son needed was control with his bodily appetites. Someone has defined character as who you are when your mother is not looking. And she started with the fiery, erotic energy that is God's gift. She said, Lemuel, give not your strength to women, your ways to those who destroy kings. She didn't want him dating loose girls or thinking of himself as a rich, princely playboy. They had the example of Solomon, for whom overindulgence in sex was a great weakness, because he had 700 wives, 300 concubines, and one of them finally turned his heart from his God to her God. Now, in the language of modern psychology, we would say that Solomon was sexually addicted. Now, how often that happens in our permissive, porn-drenched world, but at what great cost? With every illicit encounter, a young man or woman weakens their capacity to bond with a single partner for life in the covenant of marriage. According to the National Bureau of Economic Research, couples who live together before marriage have an 80% higher divorce rate than those do not. Not that the marriages cannot thrive and survive, but they are highly vulnerable. Because if you enter into intimate relationships always leaving the back door open, then you might leave. Marriage does not automatically change that habit. King Lemuel's mother wanted him to be a one-woman kind of man, and she had the courage to tell him that one deep relationship was better than a handful of shadow ones. She had seen powerful men all over Israel who developed an appetite for variety and had made a wreck of their careers and their lives and their family. She did not want that for her boy, however popular it was. There's also another vice that men are prone to that she was very careful about, and that was alcohol. You cannot make an argument for abstinence from this passage because the Bible does not teach abstinence. What this passage does teach is that the higher a man or woman goes up the pinnacle of power, to political office, to be a pastor, or to be a judge, their judgment must be clear and unclouded, because the judgments they make affect more and more people down the ladder. So she said to him, it is not for kings, O Lemuel, it's not for kings to drink wine, to desire strong drink, lest they drink and forget what has been decreed and pervert the rights of the afflicted. Every young man that I know and every young woman needs to guard against promiscuity and needs to guard against addictions. But the higher you go up the ladder of influence, the more dangerous are those practices, because they can corrupt your view of persons and corrupt your own judgment. But this was not a mother who only had a negative vision of morality, though that's where she started. She had a vision for her son being a noble king. And she said, "Open your mouth for the dumb, for the rights of those who are left desolate. Open your mouth, judge righteously, maintain the needs of the poor and needy." There were some things she did not want him to be involved in because they would rob him of his destiny, of being a king of self-control, a man among men, one who would not use his privilege for enrichment, but for the care of the poor and the needy. Every child needs to have a candle put in their hands of something noble about their destiny. On Tuesday after Ed Shelley's funeral, I was wasted. And God sent me an angel. And the angel was in the form of about a 70-year-old man named Pope, who was on the staff of the funeral home. And he met me right here. And he said, "Was your dad Dr. Jim?" I said, "Oh no, Lord, here it comes again." He said, "In 1962, I worked at J.P. Stevens in Chorale, and my wife was pregnant, and your dad was her doctor, and he'd followed her all the way through. And they're at the delivery room in Chorale, and she's got a breech birth, and he just can't get that baby delivered. So he calls a buddy of him who's an OBGYN in Florence and said, 'I drove behind him, but you know your father got in the ambulance with my wife? And he worked with her all the way down, and he helped get her out, take her into the operating room, and then he went and scrubbed up, and he and his buddy delivered that breech baby in about 10 minutes. And there's standing right there. That man said to me, 'I think your father saved the life of my first son.'" A candle was given me early in life that the privilege of a professional education and a title, pastor or doctor, whatever, was not for personal enrichment, but was for service. And that is what King Lemuel's mama, she wanted him to be sexually pure. She wanted him to not be an addict. And she wanted him to serve the least, the last, and the lost. She wanted him to be the kind of man who could relish and appreciate this wonderful woman God was going to send him. And the mama believed that God was going to send one. She wrote him a poem up to describe her. Often people come to me and say, "Pastor, I just want to marry somebody to make me happy." And I tell them, I said, "You know, the challenge is not to find the right kind of person, but to be the right kind of person. And to trust God with your desire for love and marriage." And she said, a good wife who can find. Now, folks, this is an ideal. She had to use all 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. And this woman is Superwoman. This woman never existed. But she was an outline of the virtues that Lemuel needed to look for in a queen that matched his own character and his mission in life to serve the poor and to be a king of justice, to be an emblem of what would one day become the Messiah. This woman has about 7 PhDs. She has one in textiles, food purchase, real estate, grape growing and viniculture, wisdom, marketing, and management by delegation. She's a great timekeeper. She's physically fit. She girds her loins with strength and makes her arms strong. She had better arms than Michelle Obama. Women talk about that. I've heard them. You know, "Why is she wearing that sleeveless dress?" Well, because she pumps iron every day. She was dressed in fine linen and purple. She didn't eat the bread of idleness. She did not sit around watching afternoon television and reading trashy romances. Her husband said, many women have done excellency. You surpass them all. She's generous with the poor. She's an impossible ideal. She's superwoman. And if you think you have to measure up to her, you will always fall short. I found this in an old Reader's Digest. Mother of four was talking about her neighbor who had eight children. She's amazing, she said. Her house is always neat. She's a wonderful cook, does her own sewing. Her children are polite, well-behaved. She's active in PTA, helps with brownies, is den mother for the Cub Scouts. She's pretty and has loads of personality, and she makes me sick and I hate her. Several years ago, a new book came out for women in Christian bookstores. It was titled, Do Plastic Surgeons Take MasterCard? In my 59 years, I've only met a few women in my life who were both beautiful on the outside and had godly character on the inside. Most of the knockouts that I have met, some of whom were in my churches, including a couple of Miss South Carolinas, were so strikingly beautiful that sometime around 12 or 13, that's decided all they were good for. And they rode on their looks and on the attention from men for so long, and they failed to develop the internal qualities that mark a woman of spiritual excellence. A lady came to see me one time in one of my other churches, and she's in her early 30s and was just gorgeous. When she walked in the church in a white pantsuit, men in our church had to get neck surgery because they were just spinning their heads around. I told her she could not come in at 5 after 11 because that she was not the call to worship. Please be here at 2 minutes of 11. And I befriended her, and she came to see me one day, and we sat down. And I prayed, and I looked at her, and I asked the strangest question I've ever asked in my life. It had to be God. I said, is beauty a burden? Is beauty a burden? And she put her heads in her hand, and she began to weep. She had been eye candy on the elbows of so many men that she had lost the dream of Proverbs 31 and of a healthy, whole marriage. Now, folks, nobody can meet the standards. And even the ones that do won't look like that in 30 years. And I'm not against beauty, and I'm not against makeup. I mean, in Georgetown, a lady walked out one day and said, Pastor, what do you think about women wearing makeup? I said, if the bar needs painting, paint it. Now, folks, but the pain in our culture is that the beauty industry has told women, unless you match the standards, you are not worthy. And we train our young women to think that their only goal in life is to be attractive to a man. But how do you push back against the culture that wants to reduce women to something trivial when God is calling them to have a character and a beauty and a power that is internal, that enhances whatever looks they have or don't have? I think that the beauty industry is often a source of cruel oppression for women. Charm is deceitful. Beauty is vain. But a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Does not mean you can't be attractive. Does not mean you can't have a sense of style. Does not mean you can't wear nice clothes and enjoy girl stuff. But sometimes I talk to men whose wives have $5,000 of designer clothes in their wardrobes that still have the tags on them and have never been worn. That's as much an addiction as anything else. And the church is to call men to be strong and women to be lovely, and both of us to learn an excellent character that comes from God. I mean, look at this woman. She buys real estate. She starts a wine business. She has maidens. She's into food import and export. This is not some clinging vine. This is a woman who brings honor and assets and financial power and independence to her husband. who's known in the gates. And so today, this Mother's Day, I want to honor the women in my life who've made a difference. They've all called me to be a better man, not to buy into the stereotypes of the culture, but to risk discipline and love and wisdom and care and service. A couple years ago, Dr. John Killinger, a famous preacher, wrote a creed for Mother's Day. I believe in Jesus Christ, the Son of the living God, who was born of the promise to a virgin named Mary. I believe in the love Mary gave her son that caused her to follow him in his ministry and stand by his cross as he died. I believe in the love of all mothers and its importance in the lives of the children they bear. Mother love is stronger than steel, softer than down, more resilient than a green sapling on a hillside. It closes wounds, melts disappointments, and enables the weakest child to stand tall and straight in the fields of adversity. I believe that this love, even at its best, is only a shadow of the love of God, a dark reflection of all we can expect in this life and the next. And I believe that the most beautiful sight in the world is a mother who lets this greater love flow through her to her child, blessing the world with the tenderness of her touch and the tears of her joy. Let's honor our mothers today as God commanded. Let's honor all the women God has used to shape our lives. Let us also grant them generous forgiveness, since they too are frail and faulty, just like us. And let us ask our Lord Jesus in His great love to fill the gaps of love and wisdom that they just could not ever give us. This is a passage that calls men to excellence and calls women to equal excellence. Now, early in my ministry, I thought this next hymn was a corny hymn. I have changed because the culture has changed. With a high divorce rate and a loss of Christian family life, this hymn that was written a little over 50 years ago has again become a prophetic hymn. So let us stand and sing together hymn number 695.
Hallowed dwelling where true joy and peace.